Today on The Grave Talks, Haunted in America, a conversation with author Leslie Rule. Leslie Rule was born to be a writer. Her mother was one of the most prolific true crime writers of our time, Ann Rule, and her father, William, was a high school English teacher who taught creative writing. Leslie has written 5 paranormal nonfiction books, but has also written suspense and a true crime book, A Tangled Web. I'm Carol Hughes in for Tony Bruschi, and today on this episode of The Grave Talks, a conversation with Leslie Rule, author of Haunted in America, True Ghost Stories from the Best of Leslie Rule Collection. Leslie, thank you for being on the show today. I'm really excited to talk to you. You and I kind of have a similar history. We both grew up in haunted houses. Is that what kind of prompted your interest in the paranormal, I'm guessing?
Yes, living in a haunted house definitely sparked my interest.
Something about living in a haunted house as a child, I'm always fascinated by the paranormal. I can't seem to stay away from it. I'm just really drawn to it. Do you feel kind of like that yourself?
The reason I decided to research it is because I wanted to prove to myself that there's life after death. And I think that's really what makes me fascinated. I want to see if we move on, if we live on after our bodies die. So when I started out researching, I wanted to prove it to myself. I wanted to prove to myself that ghosts exist. And there are a couple of different ways I decided to do that. One was to delve deeply into archives and find something that occurred at a particular location where apparitions were seen. And I was always looking for something that wasn't common knowledge, that it happened so long ago that people currently would not be aware of it. And at the time I started doing this, it was the 1990s. So it was harder to research back then.
You're not kidding about that. Because back then, to research anything, you would have to physically go to the location. There was no internet at that time. So you'd have to physically go there. You'd have to comb through old newspapers and stuff, I'm guessing, just to find what you're looking for. And sometimes even that, it wasn't well organized for you.
That's right.
Much harder. I tried to explain that recently to someone in college. Back in my day. Well,
the other thing I wanted was to find multiple people who would witness the same thing. People who didn't know each other. For instance, if it was a haunted hotel, I might interview an employee who had seen a ghost and get their description. And then a guest who didn't know that person who would describe the exact same thing to me. And I also found that to be validating.
With your mother being such a prolific writer, which is really an understatement, Ann Rule, who has written, what did she write? 40 books?
36.
Like a lot of books. So part of your approach to that kind of makes me think of her approach, you know, the research, the putting the story together. A lot of people just share the ghost story. It's the research behind it, the stories that you found behind the legend or the myth or the ghost that I find fascinating.
Research is my favorite part. I loved research. It's like a treasure hunt.
Okay, so you have 4-5 paranormal books. The fifth one that just came out, The Haunted in America, that's a compilation plus some news stories. But what's interesting about that is you've taken some of the stories in the other previous 4 books, revisited them. Does technology today, I'm assuming, kind of help you flesh out the stories a little bit more? Or have you found some interesting information to add to some of those stories?
I did every chance I got. And it was so easy compared to what it used to be. Like you said before, I had to fly across the country to whatever location I was investigating. Now I don't have to get off the couch. I subscribe to a number of newspaper archive banks, and it's so easy to find things. I shouldn't say easy because sometimes it takes me 3 long days to find the one piece of information that I'm seeking, but it's so easy compared to what it used to be.
Oh, absolutely. Microfiche or actual newspapers that you would have to look through. You have to look through every article to hopefully find one that applies to what you're researching.
And sometimes I did before. It's almost like I was being led to the article that I needed. That's what I felt sometimes.
Really?
Yeah. Carol, you and I were talking about how we both seem to have a strong sixth sense. And there's little things that happen like that throughout life where sometimes we feel like we're being guided.
Did you ever feel guided to a certain story or a certain location because like a story needed to be shared and needed to be told and it kind of came to you to tell the story?
I don't know what it is that causes me to choose a particular story. I look for something that hasn't been written about or shown on TV shows so many times that everybody has heard it. One of the first things I do is to look for a case that's not very popular. And if it is a popular haunted spot that everybody seems to know about, then I look for new stories. So I'm not telling the same old stories that everybody's heard.
Have you found in your investigations, there's a location where everyone says, let's say a hotel, because there's a lot of haunted hotels or theaters, either one. Everybody says, oh, that's the ghost of Elizabeth. And right. Elizabeth was an actress on the stage here. And then you do some research and you're like, it wasn't Elizabeth at all. I kind of think it might be this person. Have you run into that?
Definitely. Actually, at the Hotel Conneaut in Conneaut, Pennsylvania, there was a ghost that was known as Elizabeth. And the story was that she was a bride who died in a fire there. And she was seen wearing a long white dress, gliding down the hallways. The witnesses assumed that she was a bride. But a thorough search of archives did not bring up any stories of fires that occurred there, or at least not anywhere people died. So I started to look to see if I could find another explanation. And I discovered that the Hotel Virginia had at one time sat directly behind the Hotel Conneaut, and the two hotels were owned by the same company. Both were in an amusement park, a very popular amusement park. And there were a dozen hotels in that park at one time. These two young women in their early 20s went to work at the Hotel Virginia as waitresses. And if they wanted to go to the lake, they would walk a few steps and go through the back door of the Hotel Conneaut and cut through the lobby. So it was a very familiar place for them. One night, it was a summer night, they were invited to go on a boat ride with two young men. It was a skiff. They call it a skiff, a little bit bigger than the rowboat.
Mm-hmm.
They had a great time. They were on the lake for hours. But in the middle of the night, the boat sprung a leak. And the ladies panicked. The men were trying to get the water out. And they were using their hats. But the water kept filling up the boat. And so the ladies jumped to their feet, screaming. And that caused the boat to tip over. Both those young women drowned. And one of the men drowned too. Now, back in that era, it was the early 1900s, summer attire for a young woman was often a long white dress.
Mm-hmm.
So it may very well be the ghost of one of these ladies. And her name is not Elizabeth. One is Lillian and the other one is Alda. And she may be trying to find her way back to the Hotel Virginia. That hotel actually burned down years ago.
And so she's still there.
People say they see her.
So did you share your findings with them then and said, hey, maybe it's really not Elizabeth?
Well, I wrote about it in the book. Mm-hmm. And then I reached out to, actually, before I finished the book, I reached out to a young woman by the name of Carrie, who has done ghost tours there for years. So she was kind of an expert on the ghosts. And she was very interested to hear about this. But she's mentioned in the book, too, some of the things she told me about. For instance, there's a little boy who's been seen frequently in the TV room off of the lobby at the hotel, and people will approach him and he's usually crying and they say, what's wrong? He says, I can't find my mommy. And then he vanishes into thin air. And Carrie was actually working the front desk when she first heard about this. And one week she had two different guests tell her about seeing this little boy. And these people didn't know each other. And this story had received no publicity at this point. So I researched and I discovered that a little boy in the 1930s was playing on the dock with his siblings right outside the hotel. And he wasn't supposed to go near the water, but you know how kids are. He was 5 years old and he lost his hat and went into the lake. So he reached for it, and then he fell in. He did not resurface. and the rescuers came, by the time they found him, it was too late. And so I think it's very possible that the little boy who drowned is the one that's now being seen.
Mm-hmm. I would think, as the operator of the hotel, owner, or whatever location that you have researched, that to me would be really fascinating information to hear that story.
Yes. The hotel was beloved by the community. The community owned the hotel and what was left of the amusement park. But unfortunately, during COVID, they couldn't keep up with the cost. So that's now been sold. And the Carriott actually reached out to the owner to see if he wanted her to come give some more talks. But there didn't appear to be any interest, which is too bad. But that could change in the future.
Speaking of little boys' stories, you have another story that I found fascinating. I think it was Cimarron, New Mexico.
Yep.
There's a hotel there.
St.
James Hotel. And there's a story about another little boy there. Can you share that?
Sure. I went and stayed in the Hotel St. James about 20 years ago. And I went with my friend Sherry, and I was there to do research because it was a famously haunted place. An episode about it had aired on Unsolved Mysteries. And when we arrived at the hotel, the front desk clerk put some videos into the TV, and we watched that episode along with some other episodes about the place. And most of the stories everybody had heard. It used to be a hangout for guys from the Wild West, like Jesse James and Annie Oakley and Buffalo Bill. And there were a lot of gunfights there. And the bar is still riddled with bullet holes in the ceiling. So there was a lot of drama there. Now, the Unsolved Mysteries episode showed a reenactment of an experience that an employee had had there. It was his first day of work, and he glanced into the bar early in the morning and saw a little boy sitting on the bar spinning a bottle. So he said, "Hey, kids, you got to get back to your room." Now, in the Unsolved Mysteries episode, the boy seemed to be about 9 years old. I discovered that was not accurate, that Unsolved Mysteries had taken some creative license. I determined that the ghost was probably Johnny Lambert, the son of the owners of the hotel. Now, Johnny was 2 and a half when he died in the 1890s. I wondered if the Unsolved Mysteries episode was accurate, but I couldn't get a hold of the witness himself because he didn't want to talk about it. It scared him too badly. But I talked to his father, and he said, "My son doesn't like to talk about it, but I'll tell you exactly what he told me." And he said that the ghost on the counter on the bar was a little boy, and he had long blonde curls, and he was wearing a white nightgown. The kid was about the age of a toddler, and his son instinctively felt it was a male child. And he was spinning the bottle, and when the little boy looked up at the employee, his face was terribly scarred, half of his face, as if he'd been burned. And he leapt off of the bar and disappeared into the floor. So in the graveyard nearby, I found a Lambert family plot, and there was the grave of little Johnny. Oh, I wanted to get a picture of him because I wanted to find out if he had those blonde curls that the employee had described. I could not find an image of him. The book was published in 2001. And then a few years after that, I was on an ancestry site and found a Lambert family tree. And somebody had posted a picture of Johnny. And sure enough, he had the long blonde hair, just like the little ghost that was seen. So I think that it's very likely that that ghost did belong to Johnny Lambert.
That gave me goosebumps. And I agree with you. I think Unsolved Mysteries would be like, let's cast a boy. That boy is great. Let's cast him. And not really.
Yeah, they do a great job. I love Unsolved Mysteries. But I think sometimes when any show like that, whether it's a crime show or a paranormal show, when they do reenactments, it's supposed to be based on.
Right.
So they get close, but very rarely are they absolutely accurate.
You have another story, the personal story that happened to you. You had been working in a restaurant, and you had a coworker who was tragically killed in an accident, and then you saw him as a ghost.
I didn't realize I had seen a ghost until many years had passed. I was in my 20s, and I was waitressing. I spent about 7 years waitressing as I was writing during the day, but not published yet. And at night I would work in the restaurant. And there was a very nice young man by the name of Scott, who was a chef there. Everybody was very fond of him. He was a really nice guy, but he had just turned 21 and he liked to party. So he and his friend went out drinking one Sunday night. It was a rainy night, and his friend was driving. After they left the bar, they had a head-on collision with another car. The people in the other car went to the hospital with serious injuries, and both Scott and his friend instantly died. It was a really horrible time at the restaurant. People were very upset. About a year went by, and I was in the car with my first husband, Dave, and we were driving down Furwood Street. Furwood was a long, pot-ridden street, and we had to drive very slowly along it. So my husband, Dave, was driving, and as we passed beneath a streetlight, I saw Scott, and I recognized him immediately. He was wearing his favorite coat, and his face was tilted up toward the light, and there were tears rolling down his face. And I immediately said, "There's Scott's ghost." And I reached out and pointed. And in the next instant, we'd driven past, and I started laughing at myself. I immediately went to a logical explanation. I didn't know that a ghost could appear to look so real that you could actually see the tears on their face and recognize their coat. I had to get a logical explanation, and I immediately decided, oh, that wasn't Scott. It had to be Dustin, his younger brother, who had worked at the restaurant as a dishwasher. Once I latched onto that thought, I completely dismissed the idea that I'd seen Scott's ghost. We were just half a block from home, so we pulled into our driveway, and now I was focused on Dustin, and I was thinking, oh, that poor kid, he's walking around in the rain crying, wearing his brother's coat. I've got to go get him and bring him back to the house and give him tea and talk to him. My husband was annoyed because he didn't see what I saw. And he was, what are you talking about? I didn't see anybody. And I was annoyed at him because I thought, how could he not have seen him? We drove right past. We were going slowly. And he was on my husband's side of the car. He was so close. And we were annoyed with each other, but I put that out of my mind. Probably less than 40 seconds had passed since we pulled into our driveway, and I didn't see anybody. I should have been able to see, the street was half a mile long, and I should have been able to see somebody on the street because of all the streetlights. All the houses were shut down for the night. There was no sign of anybody. And I was still determined to find him. So I ran down that street yelling Dustin's name. And after about 15 minutes, I gave up and I went home. I put it down on my mind. I didn't think about it again until many years had passed. Now, when I had the sighting, this was before I wrote books about ghosts. I was in my 20s then, and I think I was 40 when I published my first ghost book. At that time, this was before podcasts and Skype and Zoom. So I did a lot of radio shows. When I went on the radio around the year 2001 to talk about my book, Coast to Coast Ghosts, one of the things I talked about was how people could spot a ghost if they passed them on the street. And I pointed out that sometimes a ghost can appear so solid and real, we might not realize we're looking at an apparition unless it vanishes before our eyes. And I would say one of the ways to tell is that maybe just one person, maybe there's a group of people, but just one person will see the ghost. And if no one else can see them, it's probably not a live human being. And the other thing I would talk about was how they were so often gone too quickly. You turn away for an instant, and when you turn back, they're gone. When I was doing all those radio interviews, I wasn't thinking about my experience. It was just something that had happened one night that I'd put out of my mind. So I end up writing 4 books about ghosts. And about a decade ago, I woke up one morning and you know how those lazy thoughts kind of roll through your mind and you have memories and your mind kind of goes nowhere. And I suddenly found myself thinking about Dustin crying on the road. And for the first time, I realized that that experience had two elements of a ghost sighting. My husband couldn't see him, and he was gone too fast to make sense. So I'm going to reach out to Dustin. And I found him on Facebook, and I wrote a letter, and I thought he might think I'm nuts, but I just really wanted to know if he was the one wearing his brother's coat, crying in the rain all those years ago. Now, a lot of years had gone by, and I wasn't even sure if Dustin would remember me. I got no response. So I dropped it, and I put it out of my mind for a while. And then just about a year ago, as I was getting ready to write Haunted in America, I started to think about it again. I just really wanted to know if I saw Dustin or if it was Scott's ghost. Now, there were brotherly similarities between the two, but they weren't identical. I should be able to tell the two apart. And when I was looking for the logical explanation, I decided, oh, well, Dustin must have grown up to look like his brother in the last year. I just wanted that explanation that made sense because that's what we're taught to do. But now as I thought about it, I realized they don't even really look that much alike. And I knew Scott's face very well because we worked together 5 nights a week and we worked together for a couple of years. So I decided that I really wanted an answer. So I looked Dustin up online, and this time I found a phone number for him. I called it. He answered after the first ring. He did not remember me, but he was very happy to talk about his brother. He didn't think I was a nut. He was very open-minded, and he thought the story was really interesting. And he said it was absolutely not him walking down the street that night. He didn't remember the coat, and I think that Scott was probably wearing it when he died, but he was adamant it was not him. He did not walk around the neighborhood crying. So we decided it must have been Scott. And I asked Dustin if I could put the story in the book, and he said, yes, I could. And when I wrote the story, I sent it to him, and he liked it and approved it. So that's how the story of my ghost sighting in the 1980s ended up in Haunted in America. It was the most vivid ghost sighting that I've ever had, yet I didn't recognize it when it happened. It took decades for me to realize that I had seen a ghost.
Because in part, that wasn't your definition of a ghost, because a ghost isn't just standing there. You saw your friend, and it was like, wait, we need to go back and help him. Oh, wait, that's not him. That has to be his brother. Right. I totally get how you would go through all that in your head.
Yeah, and even though I'd grown up in a haunted house, we didn't see apparitions. And I had, at this point in my life, I had seen some things, but they weren't that vivid. They were more shadowy. This was just too real. I just didn't realize, because this was before I started doing the research. I didn't even put that together until years had gone by. What I put in the book was, there's a theory that ghosts can see the future. And if that's true, Scott knew that I was going to one day write books about ghosts. And I think he appeared to me because he wanted me to warn people not to let their friends drink and drive. The tears are rolling down his face. So many people were hurt both emotionally and physically after that accident.
He needed to reach you because you would be the one to help him.
Yeah, that's what I think. Now, I'm always very clear that I don't have the answers. There are theories. I lean toward certain theories, but in no way am I an expert on ghosts, because I don't believe anybody can be, not until we're ghosts ourselves. I think there's a lot that we're not supposed to know until we're on the other side.
I agree with you so much on that. And we are going to continue this conversation. This will wrap up part one of our conversation with Leslie Rule. And if you would like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts, and you can try it for 3 days absolutely free. You can go to patreon.com/thegravetalks and get everything there, all ad free. And for all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Carol Hughes. Thanks for listening.